You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I'm so excited for this conversation. We're going to be talking to Lindy Elkins-Tanton, who is a professor at UC Berkeley and director of the Berkeley Space Sciences Laboratory, and she was lead of the NASA Psyche mission. She is the author of A Portrait of the Scientist as a Young Woman, and she's got a new book. The book is called Mission Ready, How to Build Teams That Perform Under Pressure. Enjoy the pod. Lindy, welcome to the podcast.
Kelly, I'm so happy to be on with you. Thank you.
So this book talks about effective teams using your life experience, in particular, the launch of NASA's Psyche mission. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, that's how we pronounce it anyway.
Okay, good. So let's start there. For folks who don't know what that mission was, what was it?
Yeah, it is still, by the way. So this is a kind of a mid-size NASA mission that I lead. And we, to win this mission, to win flight, we had to compete for almost 3 years against 27 other teams. And it ends up being kind of like the Super Bowl in the end, when it's just whittled down to five, because the total budget is almost $1.3 billion. And it supports hundreds and hundreds of people's livelihoods for well over a decade, or 15 years. And so people really care, and the pressure is extremely high. And we ran into all of the excitements, the gigantic challenges, the sudden bad surprises, COVID, all the things while we're building the spacecraft and going through it. And this is not unusual. Every spacecraft has a million of these moments. But the learning, oh my goodness, the learning, and then piling that on top of leadership in academia and the private sector. But there's something so focusing, and you know this, about a deadline and the threat that your whole project will be canceled if you don't meet it, and taxpayer dollars and huge oversight, that just really focuses you on how a team works. And so just like one final word there is what we're doing with this mission is we're going to an asteroid named Psyche. So we named the mission after the asteroid. And we think that it's made mostly of metal and has a metal surface. And this will be the first time humankind will ever have visited a metal surfaced object. We're going to learn about a whole new class of solar system objects. And we don't even have a photograph of this. So it's primary exploration. We're going to get there in the summer of 2029. The spacecraft has been in flight almost 1,000 days, and it's got a while more to go. It's got a long way to go. So follow along, and we're sharing images in close to real time when we get them down from the Deep Space Network. And so everyone in the world will see this crazy thing at the same time.
Is there like a website people can go to for that, or is that to
come? Yes. Yep, yep. If you search on Psyche Mission and Berkeley, you will come to our main website that has the raw image feed. And we've got a bunch of big partners in this, Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Of course, NASA headquarters is our sponsor. Intuitive Machines is our industry partner, and Arizona State University holds the contract and does all the imaging in the data center, and then on and on, 20 more organizations. But come to this Berkeley website, because that's kind of the main gathering place.
So we've been doing this podcast for 10 years, and that's after I wrote the book, Yes And, there was just sort of a bunch of happy accidents. And it continues to be these happy accidents in the sense that the publicists know me by now. They know the stuff I might be interested in. So there's a handful of those folks who just send me like, hey, you should do this. And I just do it. So I didn't know much about you or your book, but I'm reading the book. And I did a thing where this is kind of what I do when I do the notes. If I've got a galley is I draw a box around something that is like meaningful to me where I'm like, oh, I want to anchor something mm-hmm. on that. So I drew a box around a paragraph right at the beginning. It really spoke to me. And what it said was, quote, another way to think about this is how we spend the hours of our days. We need to be happy with what and who we see when we open our eyes in the morning. And we need to enjoy and value the people we spend our working hours with. For this reward, we each need to rise above being a passive cog in the machine, and we need to relinquish working just for our fame and success. What I wasn't expecting was the next line. And the next line you wrote, quote, we need to become members of a team improv troupe. We need to say yes and instead of no, and to work for the common good. So I had not actually put a box around that. That was like, oh, and then there's that. So
right, right.
I immediately felt this connection of like, oh, we're going to go on a journey together, aren't we? And the book is that. It's wonderful. It's smart. There's academic insights for our listeners. So many people you've heard in this podcast get brought up in this book. And you do a thing that I love to talk about now, which is an understanding I've got. I'm turning 60, done this stuff a long time, that we have artificially made distinctions between our businesses, our life, our all, whatever, when all of it is the same thing.
Yes.
It's all the same thing.
Oh, bless you. Oh my gosh, Kelly. Right. At the time that I wrote that sentence, I didn't realize I was writing it for you, but I was completely writing it for you.
Where did you discover improvisation? Because you also mentioned the Alan Alda School, and I know all those folks at Stony Brook.
Yes. So
where did that come in?
Oh my gosh. I don't even know where in my life. I mean, it might have started back in my childhood with two much older brothers, 8 and 10 years older than I, where the absolute purpose of every sentence of every day was to be as funny as possible. And where we have all these like meta memes about our funniness where, you know, there's a moment where you're building and you got a bit and it's going. And then one person goes like 10 steps ahead and just kills it. And then the bit is over and all you can do is laugh because they won, basically. And so, you know, I grew up in this household where that was the currency. That was the currency. And so we watched, you know, and I've grown up with, and I care so much about all the people that you brought into Second City. And, it's just everything. And that like sketch comedy and improv is the perfect comparison to do a yin and yang with academics where, you know, frankly, the people who make it to the top of the academic profession are, I'd like to call them type A plus personalities. Like they're there because they are willing to never give up on an idea and they've been brought up to, they're all sole proprietors, right? This is my idea. This is the thing I'm thinking about. My team is thinking about it. I'm leading the team. I own the idea. And it's not that everyone in academia is selfish or obsessed with fame, but there's pressure to go in that direction. And so how do you take a bunch of people who have been brought to success through that path and make them work together like an improv troupe? And I have actually stood in front of faculty meetings when I was chair or director and said, imagine that we are an improv troupe and that what you're trying to work for is team success and not just your success. And then you go into a place like the Psyche Mission, where every person on the team understands that the purpose of their existence and work every day is to achieve success for the project. And the contrast of those two cultures has driven a lot of what I've written about.
Well, I think it's why the startup culture on the West Coast got improv early. It's like, cause theater kids had to like put on the show.
Yeah.
So there's the show is going to go up or
it's going to
Lorne Michaels always talks about the fact that, you know, it's the show goes up because it's 11 o'clock, you know, that's the reason. And so, you know, startup people, theater people, I think people in sports teams, marching band, there's all these things around sort of synchrony and togetherness, small teams, that sort of thing that require, if you're going to have success, that require you to take the best parts of everyone to have sort of like playful risk.
Yeah.
You know, to have each other's backs, to everyone has to be able to tell the story of the thing that you're doing.
They've got to believe they're a part of it.
Yeah. And isn't it interesting that we all learned that in extracurricular? We didn't learn that in curricular.
I agree with you totally. This is a totally different subject, but just to say that I've designed whole undergraduate degrees where the number one rule is we don't do anything in the classroom that doesn't happen in life and work. So wow. We're not taking multiple choice tests. And when I ask a question of you, it's because I don't know the answer. It's not a pretend test where I do know the answer. So let's actually work together the way we want to work together. And to your point, and one of the things that I always say when people say to me, how do you balance work and life? I always say, I only have one thing, and that is my life. And I populate it with the things that I care about the most.
Mm. So your first chapter is the best. It's starts with a situation that you dealt with that you dubbed the Great Toilet War. We must, and look, the rest of the podcast could be about this.
Oh, yeah.
So rich. It's so funny. It's such a great anchor story. But like, tell what happened. How'd you even get in this conversation about clogged toilets?
Oh my gosh. All right. So, I was working for a big fancy organization with a gigantic endowment and a lot of, you know, gravitas. And I was in the board meeting, and I was not one of the main actors on the board. So I was sitting along the wall and checking my email while I'm listening to the board meeting, and suddenly my email, and there I'm sitting in my suit and feeling all important, and my email inbox is suddenly filled up with conversations about shit.
What
is happening to my world? How is this possible? So what was happening was our director of facilities at the little campus that I was the director for, was faced with clogged toilets in a building. And apparently, and I was fairly new on the scene, I didn't know this, but there was a history, like 20 years of history of these toilets clogging. And so like anything with history, you know what this is like. The second that topic is raised, everyone's hackles are up. Like everyone is at like DEFCON 1, and they're all talking about all the terrible things that have always happened before. And they're all pointing fingers and like, last time this happened, it was your fault, and it was your fault. And the facilities guy was blaming the women in that building for flushing sanitary items.
Of course.
Okay? Of course. And the women are not happy about this.
No.
And then everyone is just being mean to each other. And I will just say, as an aside, I don't know that I wrote this in the book. This guy who was head of facilities, I realized in the first week we worked together that he was not a yes person. He was a no person.
Oh, yeah.
And let alone yes and. He wasn't even a yes person.
No.
And I remember taking him aside before this even happened, before the email and all the toilet issue, and saying to him, you know, your job is to try to say yes. When I ask you things, you generally say no. And I want you to really think hard, because your job is to try to say yes. And I would say that's everyone's job, to try to say yes. Well, he never did become a yes person, but so what happened in this case was we didn't have any facts. All we had was a whole lot of anger. And so I decided in that moment, because this was very unfruitful and the emails were flying and people were super pissed and I'm getting phone messages and the whole thing. So I made this little rule. I said, if you cannot leave history out of your emails, then you're only allowed to send them to me. And so that way we got back to some facts. And then, you know, when I got back to campus after a couple of days, then we sat down and actually looked at the facts. And that, you know, that is like a microcosm of everything in team crisis, I think. And I'm really curious to hear how you handle things like this. You've got to make sure that nothing is ad hominem. It's never about the person. So it's not me feeling annoyed at this person for being a no person. And it's not him being annoyed at someone else for blaming him. It's got to be about the topic at hand, people removed. So what did cause the clog? For example, let's get some facts. What do we need to do to fix it? How much is it going to cost? Let's talk about things that mattered. Well, so of course, it turns out that in the end, it wasn't the women's fault. It was the fault of the cleaning products that the director of facilities was giving to the cleaning team. He refused to give them expensive, proper toilet cleaners, so they were using paper towels, and those clogged the toilet. So it was his fault and terrible for the cleaning team. So we fixed that. But it relied on not being ad hominem, getting to the topic, talking about it rationally. How do you do that? How do you, what's your advice on getting away from no and your fault and back to yes and here's the topic at hand?
Well, you did it. I mean, it is teaching people that their reflexive thoughts in any situation are shortcuts that are not going to be helpful.
Yes.
Often
yes.
The problem solving. So what we end up doing when we go into companies is we give them drills. So many people who do sort of consulting with businesses do role playing, and I get that, and I understand it to a certain degree. But just like, you know, Lionel Messi got great because he drilled himself on specific moves.
Yep.
That's what we do. So it's like, you need to work on your listening. We're going to give you now a bunch of listening skills that are going to show you
right.
what a terrible listener you are. So then you're going to have some humility entering into this thing.
Oh, humility.
So here's the other big thing with that story, and it relates completely. My next podcast is with Nick Epley, and I don't know if you know Nick's work at the University of Chicago.
Mm.
We partnered with him to create this thing called the Second Science Project, which looked at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation and vice versa.
Love it.
Richard Thaler, Danny Kahneman, like lots of people
did
this thing.
Yep.
So Epley was the one who, a lot of his work is around self-regulation.
Yes. And absolutely everything.
And this was this thing that, like, I think I knew what that was, and but probably more in a context of reading it in sort of child development. But then, you know, you work at a place like Second City, and it's like, I'm doing child development. I mean, this is, you know.
That's what we're doing all the time.
No one got into comedy because they're well-adjusted. This is hurting kittens. This is what I'm doing. With brilliance. Like it's not, you know, it's not that these people aren't brilliant, but they're human. And the thing that makes them so brilliant is often that they don't quite operate in a way that other people's operate.
Mm-hmm.
So much of your book is about setting this bedding of like, hey, before you can do any of this, you got to be calm.
Yep.
You got to enter these conversations with a level of curiosity. And this is how I would say it, which is you take a beat.
Yes, that's right.
Take a beat.
That's right. Sometimes we even call it the 24-hour rule. If there's a gigantic crisis, not to leap to conclusions, not to get everybody stirred up, but let's find out the facts first, and then we can talk about it. And I love that word reflexive. I use it all the time because that is not always where people are at their best. And just also when you're talking about hurting kittens, I think that is part of the joy of working with people who have deep capacities and are using them to a great extent in whatever field or whatever way, what you're doing, what I'm doing, the kinds of things we do in common. And I think of people almost as shapes in space. And you can have people who are kind of spherical. They have a sort of an equal capacity in all sorts of directions, and they don't create a lot of friction, and they kind of fit in with the whole, and they're going through their lives, and oftentimes they're pretty happy. And then you get people like the people that we work with, and they have some huge spiky capacity out here, but it means some other part of them is maybe not fully formed either. And then shaping, not trying to fit them into teams can be tricky. But it's that genius that makes them an unusual shape that we love about them.
Yeah, and so your job as a leader is to give them, if you can give them tools, that's great, but also structures to work inside. And we referenced this before. It's like when the show goes up or when the launch needs to happen. There's so much that richness inside this book. But one of the things I wanted to talk about, because this was a thing that confounded me when I started dealing with academics and their theories around brainstorming. So academics love to tell you that brainstorming isn't a thing. It doesn't work. You're going to be anchored by the first thing that a person says. And my big argument against this was like, well, that's not the way it works when you've got six experts who are all trained in yes and who understand that there's all kinds of possibilities in any ideas.
Right.
You seem to also understand that, well, yes, there are ways that brainstorming can go afoul. That does not mean that brainstorming can't work.
Right. That's right. Yeah, completely. And I think one of the things you said is almost the key to it. If we can check our ego at the door or just not come in with all of the biases we have about each other. Like if I come into this meeting, I'm like, Kelly is always the leader and he's going to say a thing. And then whatever he says, I kind of have to just build off that. Instead, we go in as a team of equals, all sharing what we think is important. That is so much stronger. And I love couching things as questions. I'm really obsessed with questions. I have a whole rubric of how to make your questions more and more productive. Really, really interesting. We've done years of work on this. It's not in the book. That's a different thing. But it leaves it open as to what the answer is. We're just asking questions. And, you know, there's all this great social science, which says that if you're in a room and you're brainstorming or having conversations with people who you don't feel like are the same as you, people who have whatever scale of diversity or axis of diversity you care about, then you're likely to be more thoughtful about your responses because you're not going to assume subconsciously that they're immediately going to understand and agree with you because they're not the same as you. And then you get much more thoughtful kinds of questions if you have a big mix of people in the room. And if everyone gets to speak, which is the other thing that I think is the most important thing, is making sure that the most junior and new people get to speak and that they're respected for their own expertise, then the brainstorming is magic. And you come up with stuff that nobody had thought of before.
And one of the things I loved when we're working with the behavioral scientists is that we have improvisational instincts about this stuff that tend to be correct. But then when we understand the science, it's like, oh, there's another layer.
Right.
And so it's very, very specifically, so you talk about a study that Brian Lucas and Lauren Nordgren, Northwestern, did. Brian is someone we did a ton of studies at Second City with. Lauren's been on the podcast. And the study you reference is this idea around initial ideas might be kind of like banal, but usually it's that second or third layer that get interesting. The study that we did with Brian and Eilat Fischbach and some others was we took all the beginning students at Second City. So these are all like level A students. Half of them, well, they were all taught to do a specific exercise, but half of them were simply given the prompt, hey, this is going to be difficult and just like go through it, like just keep going. The people who were given that simple prompt stayed at it longer and were more effective.
Right.
I mean, what a tiny thing to do to get what I would call a massive result.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know, this is, I think, so underappreciated by people who work with other people, that is to say everyone, that we rise to the expectations of the people around us. And so if you tell your team, you know, we didn't do well at this last time, I don't know if we're going to do well this time, we're not going to do well. That's the answer. And so if you always stand up there, and I mean, there are people who say, you know, you should temper your optimism, or like, I'm fundamentally a pessimist. And my opinion is that if you're not an optimist, you can't be a leader. You've got to believe and show that you can move to a place, and then people will believe that you can do it. And it's the same with what you just described. Let people know they can do it. Maybe it's going to be a challenge. That's okay. Sometimes when we're teaching math or science, we encourage our students to have an emotional reaction as the first thing they do to a problem they're faced with. Accept that problem. Now have an emotional reaction. Identify it. Name it. And then do something to try to solve the problem. You're just giving people permission to be their human selves and know they can succeed.
Yeah. I had no business taking or getting this job, you know, like the initial job producing at Second City. You know, I had a self-design major at my college, which was me reinserting the Beat Generation into the actual canon of English literature as opposed to outside that literature. But like, what in what world was that going to say you should be the producer of Second City? But what happened, and then I've seen this in my entire career, is that you look for young, curious people. And by the way, a great place to find them is the English majors and the performing arts majors.
Yes, absolutely true.
The history majors. And start to give them some instruction, some knowledge. And then, you know, great things can happen. We are fed this idea culturally from movies and literature and other places that somehow there's a box and a system and an order.
Yes.
Like there's no order.
There's no order. No, that's right. When I was a kid, I asked my mom once for a list of all the jobs you could have so that I could pick what I wanted. She was like,
wow.
There's no list. And that's an example. Like, I thought that there was an order and life went in a certain way, but it absolutely does not. And your comment about English majors is really apt, because I think to some degree, some percentage of people go into science and engineering because they would be comforted by the idea that there are laws and rules and processes that guide them. But of course, you know this, and I'm sure your listeners know this, that every single thing that humans do at a high level is fueled by mad creativity. And we use a different tool set, but we're all trying to do the same thing. We're trying to apprehend the world around us and make progress. And it has to do with imagining things that don't exist right now, no matter what field you're in. I think the English majors just get that sooner.
Yeah. There's a thing you talk about late in the book, and I equated it to a thing that happened at Second City. So when I stepped down and I started doing my other stuff, it was like I was a bit on an island, which I enjoyed. I had tons of autonomy. Things were going well. And then the twin things of COVID happens, and we're also going to be sold. And I'm asked by the owners at the time to come in and be the lead storyteller on the sale. So suddenly I'm back in like the driver's seat, and in a way where I'm looking around, I'm like, this doesn't quite look like the Second City that I led. And we get through this whole thing, and COVID completely disrupts the whole organization. We almost go under. We're now newly owned. And my wife, who's worked here forever as well, what we realized, we're like, you know what? There's plenty of books about Second City. There's plenty of books about improvisation. What hasn't been written down is like the cookbook about how we actually do this.
How do you really do it?
And like how we like day to day.
Yeah.
And why? And so when you talk about the lost recipe, I'm like, because we did it. My wife led that project. It was this, what we called a self-study, but it was the lost recipe. So explain what the lost recipe is, because I think that is a thing that doesn't get discussed enough in especially businesses that stick around for a while.
Oh my goodness. I'm so glad you brought this up, because I actually think this is one of the existential threats to humanity, frankly, the lost recipe. Yeah. I didn't understand. People figure stuff out and then they forget it all the time. Not just individuals, communities, societies, you name it. There we were building this spacecraft, and there was a part in our communication system that was just not being successfully delivered by the big famous aerospace company that you would immediately recognize. And so I thought a lot about escalation, and I actually got some really great advice once from one of the leaders at NASA when I was just taking on this project. He said, if someone's misses their deadline and they're late once, talk to them about it, find out why it happened, let them go on. If they're late a second time, fire them. Mm. And I don't take that approach. That's not my approach, but I will say there's something to it, because there's something systemic going on. So the minute something slips its schedule, you need to get right on top of it and find out what is going on in that team, because I'm telling you, it's going to be a deeper problem than you think. And so eventually we got to the escalation step of what's called a boarding party. And even though it was COVID, we sent people there in person. That's when you really learn what's happening. And we had to do this multiple times through the project, fly across the country, get a meeting with the vice president, meet his team, figure out what is going on. So in this case, they had lost the recipe. The people who knew how to make this part and tune it, as it was called, had retired. And the people they'd supposedly trained couldn't do it anymore. And this particular part was under a contracting mechanism called cost plus contracting, which means they can't make it. And they let us know, they send us something that doesn't work. And then they say, well, we're going to have to try again. And if you want us to try again, you have to pay us again. Mm-hmm. And I was through the roof. I was like, what is the ethics of this? How is this not a thing that, like, where's their skin in the game? Well, long story short, they had to bring back someone from retirement, the person who really knew how to do this, in the middle of COVID. And luckily she was willing to come back. Her name was Helen. She came back, she fixed the thing. About a year later, there was another thing at another aerospace company. Again, it was because the person who knew how to do it had retired, and the people who were still there didn't know how to do it anymore. And they had to bring back their retiree, and her name was also Helen. And this happened five times on the project, five major expensive times, twice their name was Helen. Turns out that Helen reached its peak popularity as a name just after World War II. So that's when all these women were training to be engineers for the first time, becoming super experts and now retiring. And so I really began to think about this. How do we not lose the recipe? And it's usually not by writing stuff down, because unless the people are very motivated to learn and the book is unbelievably exciting like yours, it's not going to work. You know, if it's just a procedures manual, it's not going to work. So one day I was having breakfast at a conference, and I happened to sit at a table and meet a new person who happened to be the chief technology officer for Sony Corporation. And I asked him, because I thought that Japan, with its very long history of passing down traditional arts and knowledge, would have an answer. And he said, well, do you know about the Issei Shrine? Which I didn't. So I started doing my research. Did you know about the East Lake Shrine, Kelly?
I didn't, but I was like, I was going to make you tell this story.
Oh my God. So this is the answer. So this is a Buddhist animist shrine that's existed in Japan for 1,000 years. How do you have an organization that does the same thing for 1,000 years? And the way they do it is every 20 years, they rebuild the shrine on an adjacent piece of property from the ground up. And the team that does that then understands how to build a shrine, how to add personnel to a shrine, how to run a shrine, what a shrine requires, what the routine is, how the routine starts. And effectively, they do it twice in their working career. And that way, there's an absolutely continuous set of knowledge for 1,000 years. And so in the end, everything we're talking about here, and I suspect everything each of us has done in our careers, comes down to the individual humans. And in this case, it's working shoulder by shoulder, talking to each other. It's that tacit knowledge that you can't really write down or articulate, but if you watch someone doing it, you pick it up. It's about being humans together. And that's what makes our work great. And that's what keeps us from losing the recipe.
And it's blowing yourself up. So literally, if I've had so many like agents and managers in Hollywood over the year being like, you guys are missing it. You hire a Stephen Colbert and you let him leave. and I'm like, yeah, you don't like he's not going to stay. We don't own him. He's not cattle. So, but also if he doesn't leave, Adam McKay doesn't come in.
Right.
If Tina doesn't leave, Amy Poehler doesn't come in. And oh, by the way, like we do these great big hit shows that we close when they're still really popular so we can do a next original show.
Love it.
And if we just keep doing this stuff, it's like suddenly we're I remember this from like a theater class in college where the reason Eugene O'Neill became such a important playwright is because he saw his dad do the same play for like 10 years.
Oh.
No innovation.
Yeah.
No ability. And like you're, and so you have to disrupt yourself. And then in business, this is exactly why these pharma companies that have been around for hundreds of years have to switch their science.
Yeah,
they're not doing the same thing they did 100 years ago because they know the science changes, but they use their infrastructure, their knowledge to pivot. So before, whatever patent runs out, they're on to the next thing.
The next thing.
And that's not, again, I don't feel like that's a thing that's taught necessarily to folks. In the same thing, like in business school, they're not really teaching sales and you're guess what you got to do when you get into business.
Yeah, no, right. That's the entire point.
Yeah.
And we all know how much more productive our brains are when we're on a new project and we're so excited about it and we just jump out of bed and we get to work. And that's peak productivity and innovation and creativity. And having that regularly instead of getting into a rut is really critical. And I see that happening in corporations when you have the first people who put together the project and they are filled with vision and all they work 7 days a week because they're just on it. This is a meme we're all familiar with, but we've also lived it and it's amazing. That period is amazing. And then they think, maybe subconsciously, maybe not at all, but some of them think that the people who come second, the one like the one you're talking about, won't be as good as the ones who came first. And we got to get that out of our heads because then they start to proceduralize. Well, this is the amazing thing we figured out. We figured out how to do it this way, and we're going to write some rules down because we want you new people who don't know anything and don't really have a lot to offer to come in and do it the way we said. But the minute you do that, then people stop innovating. You draw the box and they're going to walk in that box. And so how do you keep the team fresh forever, always innovating and coming up with new challenges? And to me, it's bringing new challenges and letting the teams run with it and welcoming those new people in and allowing them to innovate instead of insisting that things always be done the way they were.
You may not have seen it, but the show Heated Rivalry, which is getting So I read a blog the other day that apparently the studios have looked at the success of Heated Rivalry and they've been like, we gotta do more hockey. Like, guys, that's not why that's popular. It's just so funny to me that it's like, that's what you think is going on there? Oh my God.
It's always the human story. They're missing it. They're missing it. It's the person to person.
It's the person to person. And the other thing I thought of with the lost recipe that reminded me of is the idea around Chesterton's fence, if I'm saying that right. Do you know about this?
I don't. Talk about it.
It's the idea that if you're walking in the wild and you see a fence, do not tear it down until you find out why someone put up the fence.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
So, I mean, that is, you know, that, and I'll be honest too, like, and it's probably because I've worked here so long and there's the curse of knowledge that I didn't live in a world where the thread would ever get lost. I was just like, why would this is so secure.
Yes.
And here's the gift of COVID. It's not.
The things in our world, Kelly, that we thought were secure and we didn't have to think about it, turns out those things do not exist. Those are a fiction. Everything that we care about, we've got to figure out how to nurture it.
Yeah. And how to pivot and how to change.
Yeah.
And that's going to be uncomfortable. So we have to create room. I still, you know, and I'll still hear this from folks here and other places, which is like, everyone wants to solve these difficult problems right away. And you're like, that there's not a world in which that happens.
No, that's right. And so this comes back to how we are with our families and friends, what happens in school, what the workplace is like. And I think at its most reductionist, it's about making sure that every individual person knows that they have the agency to solve problems and make change and persist. And we don't right now live in a society where that is true. You start with kind of a sorting hat style of education where some people are told that they are A+ students and they get to make decisions and be leaders, and the other people are not and they can't. And that goes back to what you said. If you tell those people over and over again, you're not good enough, they're going to begin to internalize that,
sure.
Right? And then they're not going to be decision makers. They're not going to have agency. They're not going to realize that their world is in their hands. And when they see a problem, they need to pick it up and solve it. And so trying to solve that on a day-to-day basis with everyone we interact with, help everyone understand they get to solve the problem in front of them and that it's a privilege and that it doesn't happen overnight and the answer is not in the back of the book and you just keep persisting. I feel like that's the secret to success on every level, you know, in your business, with your project, as a nation, as a species. That's what we need, that individual agency.
Yeah, 1,000%. All right, I literally could talk with you for all time. We do have to end the podcast, and we always end it asking our guests for a yes and story. I imagine you have one for us.
I do have one. I really thought about what I wanted to talk about, and I wanted to choose a story where my reflexive answer was no way, no.
Love it. Yep.
And then I had to stop myself and turn it around into a yes and. And I do talk about this a little bit in the book, but there was a moment when someone in my organization had been accused of bullying and harassment. And a group of junior people in the organization were just outraged and enraged. And in fact, that was the moment when I coined my term, the pre-enraged. So these are junior people who many times in their lives had already seen cases where people were harassers or bullies and there'd been no justice done. And so they came in on a hair trigger. Like the minute a thing happens, they're already in full-blown rage. So they came in pre-enraged. And I don't blame them, right? This is a thing we've all been through. And until you reach a certain level of power and can make some change, you got to put up with it to some extent. So they came in like, oh my gosh, like it was a scary room. And basically they were demanding that this person be banned from the organization, that they had to stay at home, that if they were going to come to the organization, there had to be an announcement made to everyone so they would know when and where they were going to be, and that the organization immediately reveal every step that was being taken in the case. Okay, and so you could imagine, I think it doesn't take a lot of imagination, that my immediate reaction would be no way, none of those things. Like A, legal, B, ethical, you know, all the reasons. But then I realized that this was just going to make the rage worse and that they were already differentiating between themselves and me and that I was a representative of the organization and the organization was automatically untrustworthy and other. And so I did realize that I had to turn to yes and. And so the first thing I did was I said, I am a human being just like each of you, and I'm here really trying to do my best. And it actually really hurts my feelings when you yell at me. Yeah. Because I have really worked, and I tell you, I could list my bona fides on this topic. I really care about this topic, and you may not ever have a stronger advocate for what you want. So I would be so great if you could just not yell at me. And so most people stopped yelling at me. That was pretty awesome. And then when I was thinking about what would really feel fair, I stopped. I took off my reflexive leadership hat. And I realized that we're never going to talk about the case because that is completely wrong. That's not going to happen. And again, I could do the old saw, like imagine if it was you, someone, and you know, you didn't do it. We don't know about this person, but you would not want all of your details put out there. Right. Mm-hmm. And so let's be correct about this. But then I realized that what they were missing was a sense of accountability. Mm-hmm. And so the yes and had to be, we're going to trust and support our organization because that is the way to make a better organization. We're going to let the organization know that we're watching and that we are trusting. And we're going to put some limits on that. And so if we don't hear anything by such and such a date, we're going to take such and such an action. And we're going to help our organization to be accountable. It's this find the third way where mm-hmm. everyone in the picture is treated like a human being, the way that you would like to be treated like a human being, and that we believe the best and we work for the best. And so that was a moment where yes and really, really helped me. I felt like to be a better person and also helped the organization. It did turn out well. And if I had gone with the reflexive no, I can't even imagine. It would have been really bad.
Yeah. So the way you're talking about this was the insight I received when we started working with the FBI hostage negotiation folks. At Quantico, and it hit. I don't know that it hit me in the first week when we were doing that because the whole thing was like a blur. It was great, but it was a blur.
It must have been amazing.
It was, and then we got invited to their annual conference in Baltimore to present, and I had so many conversations afterwards with folks who talked about because what do you have to do in that hostage negotiation situation, which is you have to create a relationship with the person who's took the hostage. So everything as a human would be like, this is a bad person who's doing a bad thing and people are going to die.
But and it's I don't because, want to hear anything they say.
Yeah. But also they're that they have to affect an outcome, a life and death outcome. And the way to do it is through building relationship.
Yes. Yes.
Oh my God. Like if there's not a bigger testament to like, okay, this is, I said this to Ron Friedman yesterday when we were taping the podcast, which is, isn't it interesting that everything we were actually taught in kindergarten or from Mr. Rogers is what we should have taken with us and everything else is bullshit.
Absolutely
and
true.
Like, why did we not, like, it's already in front of us. We have the book.
We have the book. I agree with you completely. And that is, I mean, I've never been in a hostage negotiation situation.
Thank God.
But I think very often when people are really confrontational and difficult to be with, it's because they're feeling unbelievably disrespected and not listened to. I feel like that's the foundation of so many things. And so that hostage technique of ask the person to tell you more about what they're feeling and what they want. Let them talk to you about what's really inside of them. And that is healing to many, many people in many circumstances.
The book is called Mission Ready, How to Build Teams That Perform Under Pressure. Lindy Elkins-Tanton, thank you for coming on the pod.
Oh, thank you so much. This was wonderful.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com. Or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.